Okay, we can begin the hearing. Yes, just thank you, Guy. We have read the legal submissions and the supplementary evidence. And I don't think anyone has any questions of you. But I do have some questions of Mr. Ferguson, but not many.
Yep, so good.
I'm sorry it's meant that you'd have to travel all the way over here.
I was aware that you did probably have questions for me, but I thought I'd come just in case. And I'll also introduce Hamish McCroskey, who you remember from the rural chapter, but for the benefit of the other two, he's the ski area management consultant for TC and Soho. So in case questions can be assisted with ski area management responses, Mr. McCroskey's here, just in case.
Good thought, because that was in fact going to be my first point. You were going to talk to Mr. McCroskey and confirm whether or not you were looking at subdivisions just in the ski bases and in their environments, or across the ski areas. You thought the former, but he would need to confirm.
Mm.
But
yeah.
So what's the answer?
Yeah.
Well, I guess it's considered in the context of visitor accommodation, which we've talked about in the rural sector. And from a practical nature, it's not about putting visitor accommodation across a whole wide expanse of a ski area. I mean, the purpose of a ski area is for skiing, so you take the best terrain and areas available for all levels of skiing to accomplish that activity first and foremost. Then in terms of ski area development and ski area planning, it's all about finding a terrain and lift balance that balances the number of people with different levels of skiing or riding or whatever they do with the terrain and with the lift and the lift capacities. And then it's a matter of saying where can the other ancillary activities fit in without intruding onto the skiing terrain. So it's not about carte blanche subdividing across a whole
So the follow-up question for Mr. Ferguson is how you capture that answer in your suggested rule, which currently would allow subdivision across the entire ski area.
Can I assist you, Mr. Ferguson, that the way I read the rule at the moment, where it says subdivision for ski area activities, would mean that you could subdivide each pist off, and I don't think that's intended.
Well, obviously there's a relationship with the commercial aspects of that, I imagine. But in terms of the intended effect of the rule, it was exactly like that, to intend to apply to the ski area activities that are occurring within the ski area subzone.
Is it a situation where the building or land use consent would pre-exist before the subdivision?
Well,
I'm just trying to get a handle. I mean, because I know that there are instances where you might develop a village where you do a subdivision and let individual developers develop different things, or is it intended that you would be a building which then would be subdivided and sold off in parts or leased, long-term leased, I think was the major issue.
Yeah, there might be two answers to that question in terms of the planning response of whether that could happen from a planning perspective, and there might be a commercial response in terms of whether that's intended. Perhaps we could deal with the commercial response first in terms of whether or not it is proposed to create vacant lots to enable that development.
I think it's to provide flexibility to enable commercial opportunity if it arises, in the sense of it could be a unit title or it could be a lease or it could be, but it's providing a mechanism that doesn't, or it facilitates that opportunity.
Could it be, I'd sooner we sort of went back and forth on this than try and formulate clever answers.
No, that's fine.
And I'm just wondering whether it's a situation where you might have like a development plan and then it gets approved by some mechanism. We'll worry about that mechanism subsequently, but then subdivision in accordance with that would be a way forward.
Well, that's what we've proposed, exactly what we've proposed in relation to the visitor accommodation activities that would create the landscape and ecological management plan. And the landscape and ecological management plan is, of course, a spatial layout plan.
Mm.
And that's intended to deal with the relationship of buildings to open space. It's also there to deal with landscape and ecological values in themselves, as well as indicative subdivision. So it provides a nice mechanism to enable that outcome exactly in terms of the visitor accommodation activities as it's being sorted in the submission.
What would the status of that plan be? Would it be actually in the district plan?
No. It's a secondary spatial planning tool, much in the same way that you might think of an outline development plan or a spatial layout plan. And I'm aware that there's different meanings to those words used in different districts, so I might explain it in another way, to say that it's not a plan that's embedded into the district plan, but it's a plan that's created through a rule in the district plan to then guide subsequent development and subdivision.
Question from Ms. Baker-Galloway. Does that fall foul of the decision of the
PC19.
No, the three Environment Court judges on the unitary plan rejecting framework plans that then altered the rules, this activity status of.
The way that the rule, we were very conscious of that when we drafted the rule initially in our original subdivision, the activity being consented is visitor accommodation, and one of the prerequisites to qualify for the restricted discretionary visitor accommodation rule is that the application must contain a landscape and ecological management plan as part of the application. So the activity being consented as visitor accommodation, one of the requirements, if you want to come in through the restricted discretionary route, is that part of the application is the landscape and ecological management plan. And then matters of discretion relate to that as well. So it's not set in stone that the output, the consent that gets granted, will have the final form of the landscape and ecological management plan that goes with the consent for the visitor accommodation.
So they're done at one hit rather than sequentially?
Yes. Yeah.
Could you remind me where Mr. Ferguson's evidence in the rural stream?
In the rural stream?
Because that's where the rule is, isn't it?
That's where we started with it. Yeah, that's when we sought it. Yeah, but he's repeated it in a supplementary.
It's in the supplementary.
Yeah. So,
In this evidence.
So page three of the supplementary.
I can think of at least one precedent for that occurring, and that is.
Page seven.
Changing a little change of pace in the Waikato Regional Plan provisions governing geothermal systems. There is a provision that says that if you file your application in a development system with a system management plan, your applications are considered as discretionary, and if you don't file one with a system management plan, then they're non-compliant.
Right.
Well, this framework is intended to follow that general schema, and is based off the solution that was derived by the Environment Court with Plan Change 19 for spatial layout plans. A way to overcome it was using, as Galway says, the activity is consented. The information which is included with that activity was, in that case, a spatial layout plan. So we've used a slightly different terminology in calling that a landscape and ecological management plan, because that suits a better description of what we're trying to achieve. And then any activity that occurs on the mountain that, in the absence of that resource consent, I think becomes triggered under page 8, the rule 21.5.3.5 at the top of the table there, that picks up in subdivision use or development of land within this area subzone for VA purposes in the absence of a resource consent granted under that spatial land plan rule or landscape and ecological management plan rule.
I think, yes, I think what hadn't been apparent from the rule on page 9, which is the intended subdivision rule, is it actually doesn't cross-link back to 21.5.32, and that if it was a spatial ecological management plan granted consent under that rule, then there'd be clear that that consent had to exist before you could then do the subdivision. You can get the subdivision consent at the same time, but you can't get the 224.
More words needed is what you
mean.
Yes, yeah.
Yes. Yep. That's what was...
So a landscape and ecological management plan approved as part of a consent under 21.5.32. It actually needs some additional words, doesn't it?
And is that in terms of the matters of control?
No, this gateway into this controlled subdivision rule. At least we just need more words here to make sure that it's about an actual granted, consented landscape and ecological management plan, rather than just a landscape and ecological management plan that won't have any actual status.
Yes, which is probably an observation which can be made in respect of others, the other elements of that rule as well.
Mm. Yeah.
Yes. Oh, yes. I mean, the Jack's Point structure plan, for instance, needs. Yeah, and there are other.
Well, the structure plans are fine because they are in the plan.
Yes.
It's the spatial layout plans which are created by a rule and a consent for another zone.
Which I think would have to be exceptional circumstances included in the plan. And I think what. And it's necessary to avoid that framework decision that the wording is correct.
Yes. Mm. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, that makes sense. Mm. That linkage needs to be more explicit. Mm.
And coming back to where I started with this discussion, given Mr. Crosty's answer, do these provisions need to be tied to subdivisions within or in the immediate vicinity of the existing ski bases?
So is it just around the ski base that subdivision might be?
No, not necessarily.
No. Yeah, so you can explain where else it might be useful.
There are, within a ski area, there are suitable pods, if you like, where visitor accommodation could be, such as a small lodge.
The snow farm example springs to mind.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, although they're lodges. Well, the base
area. They're rather more primitive than what you're thinking.
Yeah. Somewhat. But also for, you know, a food and beverage outlet, for example, remote from the base area. So it's enabling that sort of development. But sympathetic to the environment and within the scope of the plans that are provided. And what happens normally in a ski area development is that there's always a master plan to get all of that balance that I talked about before. The master plan sometimes is dynamic, it's not always cast in stone, but the principles remain the same in terms of getting the right terrain and lift balance, so you've got the right amount of lift to put the right amount of people in the terrain so you're not overcrowding it and all of those sort of things as well. So
the example would be at Cadrona, where they've got effectively a separate base at the bottom of the captains.
Yes. Yeah.
And European examples where you have ski in, ski out like a pizza joint or maybe yes. Heidi's Hut on Corrie Quay, that kind of thing.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. I think the real issue is making sure that that master plan is encapsulated some way in the resource management process,
yes.
so that there is the council has a surety of what's happening, so that when a subdivision consent comes in, it is all linked together. But I think that's what we're really trying to achieve.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
I'd be a brave person not to have such a plan to.
We go to the detail of your role, Mr. Ferguson. I noted the same wording in both your 21.5.32.3 and 27.5.7.E.3. So let's just look at the subdivision one for convenience. The wording's the same. So 27.5.7.E.3. First question.
You mean the wetlands and bogs?
Yes, wetlands and bogs.
Wetlands and bogs.
In terms of an area of council control, does reserving council's control over the identification of things achieve anything in particular?
Not in itself, I don't think, but the, so the wording which turned out to be better in respect of that particular matter might be to use the same approach as Roman I, which is identification and protection.
And the second question is that should that be indigenous flora and fauna, significant indigenous flora and fauna?
Yes. Yes, agree.
Well, we're on that rule. Is the intention that also be in accordance with a landscape and ecological and management plan for the entire activity?
Well, the relief that was sought in the submission was only related to the visitor accommodation.
I know that's the reality. I'm just wondering whether that may have been what you sought, but I'm just wondering whether practically and what you might achieve, whether this should equally, albeit it's not related to visitor accommodation, if it's other commercial activities, then also would be part of the ecological management plan, wouldn't it? Be identified?
Well, it could be, yes. It wasn't promoted as such in terms of the submission or in terms of this change here. And I think,
but to be fair, I don't think you've got a very strong resource management case in an area of outstanding natural landscape to say you can have a controlled subdivision with very limited controls.
Well,
so we have to look at something a little bit more definitive, because it raises the very first thing we raise, that rule allows individual pistes to be subdivided off.
Mm.
And we have the problem that Mr. Harworth for the Upper Clutha Environmental Society was telling us this morning of 40 hectare lots suddenly having to be considered as farms because they're an individual site in the rural zone and being entitled to buildings and things like that. That's not the intention, I know. I'd sooner the rules map the intention rather than be wide open, if you like.
Right.
You can see Mr. McCrosby nodding, which is helpful.
Well, I would make the point case it's not, you know, from the clear that the policy is there, you know, the obscure subzones are intended to be excluded from the categorisation of landscapes.
But they are outstanding natural landscapes. That was the only reason I went skiing, to be in them. Unfortunately, I can't ride the ski, but I understand that next year Cadrona's going to be providing a lift that I can get up to the top without skis on.
Ms. Baker Galloway would also be familiar with the concept of the problems of deeming things to be that which they are not, which is effectively this thing. We're deeming this not to be an outstanding landscape, although manifestly it is.
Well, it's a planning response to enabling the development to occur without creating the policies. Absolutely, I agree. I mean, you go out there to enjoy the landscape and there's no artificial distinction between what you can see over that ridge and the ridge that follows. Absolutely agree. But in terms of the planning response, it has appropriately tried to manage that tension between the policies which are there to enable the growth, the consolidation, and the development within the sphere of subzones.
And that's
the way that it sought to reconcile that difference. So,
and that's an appropriate thing. Especially ecological management plan is there to do.
Well, exactly. I mean, that's the policies that do enable the growth and consolidation and development of the ski areas are all subject to, I think, the avoidance remedy and mitigating effects on the environment anyway. So there's still a responsibility for managing the effects. And so this is one method by which that was promoted.
So is what you're exploring whether we can extend the requirement to have a landscape and ecological management plan to the other ski area activities in the rural chapter that would then integrate with the subdivision rules to ensure their integration and protection? Is that what we're exploring?
Well, the visitor accommodation activities provides for the landscape and ecological management plan. The only other activities, really, that we're talking about are commercial activities. And I'm wondering whether there is actually, in resource management terms, a distinction that would mean that they shouldn't be also in that same plan.
I think what we have to all keep in mind is what there's notified, what was... what required consent and what didn't, and commercial activities doesn't require a consent in the ski area subzone, does it?
Well, if it's a...
Buildings, ski toes, night lights and...
And retail.
Retail and sort of ski area activity are controlled activities.
But a commercial activity in a building is still a building.
Oh yeah, the building is a consent, absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. The building is still controlled.
Yeah.
A commercial activity that has nothing to do with the ski area activity.
That would be discretionary.
That would be whatever that is under the rural zone.
Mm.
Couldn't tell you. Might be discretionary.
Such as ski teaching or something
like that. Yeah, ski teaching might be ancillary to a ski area activity, which is fine. And that probably doesn't trigger a requirement for the consent other than in association with the building that it goes in.
Mm. Yeah.
It's
the buildings that are more important than the.
Yes.
I mean, I don't want to relitigate the rural section, but I'm just thinking that there needs to be a link for all activities for which subdivision occurs to the same things. It seems to me illogical that if it's a cafe, you can just subdivide it wherever you like. As a controlled activity without any ecological management plan, but if it's a two-room chalet, it does require one.
Mm.
That doesn't seem to be sensible resource management.
Mm. I think the main theory behind treating visitor accommodation differently than the other ski area activities was that was the activity where there was the potential for the proliferation of buildings associated with it. So that was the one that justified the restricted discretionary framework, and the one where the Derby entities wanted to volunteer the landscape and ecological management plan as a requirement to make sure that it was all carefully planned.
Mm.
And that was treated differently to the other ski area activities, which weren't expected to proliferate for the sort of lift terrain balance reasons and everything else. You've got to squish into the the ski field area. So that was where the real management was required of the visitor accommodation.
But thinking ahead, knowing what the developers and visitors at the Porter Heights ski field could have 25 restaurants up there subdivided off with the individual lessees, while it would provide a great opportunity for skiers to have that much choice, you have to question whether that is any different in effect from visitor accommodation and whether it should be treated differently or the same. That's what I'm getting to. And I can understand the distinction between ski lifts and gondolas and the other sorts of buildings.
So the base infrastructure that creates the ski area activity and the recreation opportunity is quite different from a commercial opportunity.
Precisely.
Yeah, no, I can understand.
And the nature of the buildings is quite different too.
Yeah.
I think you've probably given. Yes, because that's pretty unusual for anything else. I think we've explored that sufficiently, and we have enough in the answers to know where I think we might end up.
Great.
Okay. We just have to make sure we reconcile with what we decide in the rural chapter.
Yeah, that's right. It needs to be integrated.
And that's my job to do that. So.
Yeah.
And that's what we're sort of. In answering the issue around subdivision, of course, we sort of have to go back and sort of unwind a little bit of what was done with rural to make that fit better. So they do work quite closely together, you're right.
Yeah.
I think so. Yeah.
No, that's fine. Firstly, if in reply you could prepare a table and just identify where the things from Chapter 15 have gone into Chapter 27.
Just showing you, just so you can identify the existing provisions that have been carried through.
Yes, and if there are omissions, if you could identify those, because the submissions provide a scope to fix those omissions if necessary. The other thing that I would find quite helpful, not because we've come to any conclusion on the matter, but to enable us to come to a conclusion, is if you could prepare assessment criteria to be used in association with the various restricted discretionary and controlled activity rules, to the extent that at the moment I know it relies on the policies.
Yes.
And I'm just a little worried that we may not have captured everything, and it would be helpful if you could could prepare that just as a, if you like, something that we could use if we decided to approach, rather than you don't have to recommend that we use them, but just for our assistance.
Yes, yeah, so I started looking at taking, I think it was our last hearing where that was mentioned. So.
Effectively on the basis of if you're going to have assessment criteria, these are what they might look like.
Yes.
I think there was concerns that some of the matters of discretion read like assessment criteria. So I'm in the process of actually amending those.
Fixing that problem. Yes, that would help too.
But I think that automatically means that there's likely to be assessment criteria that come through in my office's closing response.
Yes, thank you. Do you have any things?
Just wondering about the status of the Wakatipu floor plan and if we can get some kind of update on that.
Okay, well I can't update you at the moment because I don't know where that's at, but I can follow up and provide a panel with...
I think you could, probably the best thing to do with that would be to get Ms. Scott to include it in her closing submission,
yes.
Rather than it being your responsibility. It's all on your shoulders now. I'll adjourn the hearing until 10 a.m. on Monday the 12th of September.